Welcome to Modern Church History. I'm Teresa Holman, and with me is Father Michael Witt. Welcome, Father.
Thank you, Teresa.
It is show number 73.
73. Okay.
I believe we're going to continue talking about Israel
right.
and its establishment and difficulties right. they've continued to have over the years.
Yes.
But I see in front of you quite a stack of interesting collection of literature, it looks like.
It is. I thought it might be good for us as we're getting underway to talk a little bit about bibliography.
Great.
Give some recommendations for some books for anyone who'd be interested. This is a complex topic. We mentioned that last week or two. It's complex, and there's a lot to it. And so I thought it would be good for us just to talk about some of the authors that that have written on this area that are well-researched and have a lot to say. The first one I'm going to start out with, I'm going to start with the best.
Okay.
Okay, and then go from there. But the author I'd like to present is Bernard Lewis. And he's written a number of books. He's a rather elderly gentleman now. He had taught at Princeton University. I believe he's retired now. But he is a real shaker and mover concerning Middle Eastern policy. And a short book that he wrote recently, it just came out this past year, I believe, is entitled What Went Wrong? The Western Impact and the Middle East Response. Mm-hmm. And so when he's talking about what went wrong, he's actually quoting Arabs. You know, how is it that that they had such an advanced civilization as you come out of the Middle Ages, way beyond anything in the West, and then today they're sort of like the stepchildren of the world? What went wrong is their question. And he goes through, it's a not a very long book. It was published in 2002, so
okay.
it's pretty current. About 150 pages long. And really insightful. So I really recommend Bernard Lewis, and he's had some other books that have come out too.
Okay.
Really available. Another one, if you're interested specifically in the time period that we had just been talking about last week, it's entitled One Palestine Complete, Jews and Arabs Under the British Mandate.
Hmm.
And this is Tom Segev, and it's a very, very thorough study of those 20 or 30 years in which we have the British basically trying to balance off two people with one piece of real estate and how that came about. Another one that is also, and that's a rather recent book itself. Let's see, we're looking at 1999,
okay.
that one. An older book that is brief but gives a lot of detail is called The Origins of the Arab-Israeli Wars. And this is by Richie Ovendale. I mentioned him, I think, mm-hmm. earlier on. And as I say, it's an older book, but it covers that same period of time pretty darn well. And it came out in 1985. First edition was 1984. And then when we get into a little bit more current stuff, another one that is a really strong book, a good one covering a lot of the contemporary situation, is called Jihad, The Trail of Political Islam. And that's Giles Keppel, who's the author of this. And this book is just, yeah, it was also published in 2002.
Okay.
And then along with that, a good companion book with that, very readable, is called The Age of Sacred Terror. And this is by Daniel Benjamin and Stephen Simon. Daniel Benjamin was a foreign policy expert for the Clinton administration.
Okay.
And this book was published in 2002 also.
Okay.
A lot of stuff coming out around then. And then finally, I've got the audio version right here, but another book that is pretty powerful is Peter Bergen. Now, both Benjamin and Bergen, you'll see from time to time on news programs. They're both considered to be experts on this in this field.
Okay.
And as I say, Benjamin's book is The Age of Sacred Terror. Peter Bergen's book is entitled Holy War, Inc., the inside of the secret world of Osama bin Laden. Very interesting book, because this fellow had actually interviewed bin Laden, I guess it would be about 5 or 8 years ago. Actually went to Afghanistan, was taken to bin Laden very secretly, and had an opportunity to find out what's in this man's mind, what's he doing. And, of course, we found out kind of late in the game. But these are all, I think, very, very fine books. If somebody doesn't have anything to do between now and Christmas, they can start reading that. But as I say, those are well-balanced, and I will give a lot of insight into what we're talking about these days.
All right.
Okay. Well, ready to jump into a lot of wars?
I guess so.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sorry, but that's the way it is. This is a tumultuous place, and I think it's important for us to understand the complexity of it, the amount of blood that's been spilt, the amount of revenge and anger that is part and parcel of the event, and it helps to helps us understand why this problem is so intractable, and how short of divine intervention, I don't know how it's going to be solved.
Right. You
know? Well, we're dealing with two movements, not only two peoples, but two movements. Zionism, which is different from Semitism. It's possible to be, and we've seen this already last time around, it's possible to be anti-Semitic and pro-Zionist at the same time. The idea being that it would encourage the Jewish population of your country to leave and go to Israel or any place. And so there's that. So you have Zionism. At the same time, within the Arab community, there are two movements underway, both of them sort of bolstering each other and sometimes at odds with each other, interestingly enough. And one of those is resurgent Islamism, which we'll be looking at, and it takes various forms, because Islam is not, it's a billion people, but it is a very diverse billion people. And not all of them are Arabs. Majority are, but not all of them are Arabs. In fact, the largest Muslim country in the world is not. It's an East Asian country, Indonesia. And then along within that is also Arab nationalism, which is not necessarily identified with Islam. It is for the most part, but not necessarily. And in those cases, you have various Arab national groups that are working at odds with each other, against each other. Remember, we talked about the possibilities of a United States of Arabs that would run from Morocco to Iraq. That was a pipe dream, and we'll see how that is probably never going to happen. Well, of course, we could say the same thing about Europe, and we do have the European Union now, but it militates against it.
Mm-hmm.
What's causing all of this and causing this to take place after the Second World War is the massive numbers of migrants, the huge exodus out of Europe that takes place. Once the dimensions of the Holocaust are realized, then people begin to get up and move. And it was perfectly obvious. Also, by 1946, 1947, is perfectly obvious that the two countries that one would think they could rely on for help in these cases, the United States and Great Britain, fell down woefully throughout the 1930s and 1940s. To give you an example of this, until 1945, the United States took in, before and during the Second World War, only 275,000 refugees.
Wow.
180,000 of those were Jews. But that's all, only 180,000. And our argument was that, we had the Great Depression. Our argument was that we didn't have any room. But, this huge country, well, Great Britain was a little bit better than we were as far as refugees. They took in 300,000. So a country that size actually took in more refugees than we did. But among those 300,000, only 70,000 were Jews.
Huh.
So not much of a good track record there either. the British had from the very beginning rejected the idea of a two-state plan in favor of a provincial Palestine. As Segev points out, whole and complete. So this is going to be an argument that's going to go on for years. In fact, it's being argued today of what should this entity look like? Should it be a single country or should it be two countries side by side? And there's shifts that take place. Today, the Israeli position is that there should be two countries side by side. The big fear is simply one of demographics. Mm-hmm. The Israeli population is not growing at all, and the Palestinian population is growing very rapidly. So within a generation or so, if it were one country, you would have an overwhelming Palestinian majority within Israel itself. Mm-hmm. So anyway, as things were coming to a halt as far as Europe is concerned, things almost immediately began heating up. World War II is coming to an end. In Palestine, things began heating up almost immediately. By June of 1946, five British officers were kidnapped by Israeli terrorists. And most of the terrorism that's going to happen in the first couple of years is going to be Israeli terrorists. 1947 is a real turning point in the relations. It's that time in 1947 that a wing of the King David Hotel in downtown Jerusalem is blown up. And with that, 91 people are killed in that event. It's done by the Irgun. Which is to say, remember, one of the two Israeli terrorist organizations. The leader of the Irgun is Menachem Begin, who'll clean himself up and become a legitimate politician later on. Also complicit in that is the Haganah, the Jewish army in Palestine. Shortly after that, you have a 16-year-old Zionist terrorist who was captured. He was tried and found guilty of terrorist activities, but by British law he was too young to execute. Okay. And so the judge then ordered him to be caned with 18 whips, and then following after that an 18-year prison sentence. The Irgun's reaction to that was to kidnap four more British officers and to cane them. Now, the British government's response to these officers who had been kidnapped and beaten like this, and this is, I think, an important lesson for us, because people in the Middle East learn these lessons and they follow them. Mm-hmm. And the lesson that they learned was that if you dish it back to a Western country, the Western country will fold. And that's exactly what the British did. Once they saw the news reports of their own officers being whipped, they then dropped all corporal punishment. Hmm. You know. Followed after that is a murder of 20 soldiers. This, again, was a terrorist act. It was at an officer's nightclub in Jerusalem, British soldiers. 20 of them were murdered in this one act. And with this, you begin to have now a shift in British sentiment at home. There is now a shift away from staying the course and seeing this thing through to an end, to instead develop what we would call today an exit strategy. Mm-hmm. You know, the Zionists were well aware of this. Now remember that these are the same people who had been working with, you know, just 20 years earlier, working with the British government in order to get the Balfour Declaration, in order to get set up. Now they're pushing the envelope further and further, harder and harder, and they're playing to public sentiment. They're playing to the press. And so what they did was they upped the ante by bringing a ship to Palestine. The ship has been named the Exodus. In fact, the book, and Leon Uris's book and the movie is all about this incident, as well as the founding of the state itself. They crowded on 4,500 refugees. Wow. Onto this ship and brought them to Palestine. This would have caused an incredible uproar, as you can well imagine. So the British turned around, refused to allow entry into a Palestinian port, and turned the ship around and sent it back to France. And now this, for this, the British got terrible press.
Mm-hmm.
They were roundly condemned by many, many people. Now, immediately after that, two more British soldiers are captured, kidnapped, and then they're hanged. They were murdered. And they were done, the murder was done in such a public way that everyone saw this. And not only that, but the bodies were booby-trapped, so that those who tried to come and rescue them would be injured also.
Oh my gosh.
Again, this got into the British press. And with this, more and more people were upset. They said, just get out of there. You know, we have no business there. Cut and run. You know, cut our losses. Even in Parliament now, members of Parliament began questioning the British policy in Palestine and calling for a unilateral withdrawal. Just get out. Ultimately, the exodus was not accepted in a French port. It finally landed in Hamburg, Germany. Now, the irony of that, you know, here, 4,500 Jews not being accepted in Palestine and instead ending up in post-World War II Germany. Just, it was a PR disaster. While that is being played out in the British press, in the United Nations, there is haggling going on as to what to do next. And finally at the UN, and remember the UN is only about 2-3 years old, Great Britain turns around, she's a member of the Security Council, turns around to the United Nations and says, here, you can have the mandate back, we don't want it anymore. And so in November of 1947, a United Nations commission came up with the idea of dividing Palestine into two parts. Part of it for the new state of Israel, part of it for Palestine. The United States gets involved in this because they were afraid, that if these two states came about, that it would lead to instability. And the instability would then invite the Soviet Union to come into that area. Certainly the Soviet Union had always been very interested in Syria, in Iraq. At one point in 1945-46, it actually invaded Iran, and it was only slowly persuaded to get out of Iran. So there's always been a Soviet interest in this. While there isn't much by way of natural resources in present-day Israel, in the Palestine area, it is very important for geopolitical reasons. Remember that it's the spot in which three continents come together, Asia, Africa, and Europe. It's always been an important spot. And also the United States, besides its concern for foreign policy, also the Truman administration was very concerned for its domestic policy. Harry Truman is not uncognizant of the fact that New York State had 47 electoral votes. It was the largest state in the Union at the time, and a lot of that rested upon New York City, and particularly those Jewish boroughs. And so there's great concern over that. Well, what happened is that no sooner does the UN Commission come up with the concept of the two states than the British literally cut and ran. On May 14th of 1948, at the evening taps, the tattoo in which the flag is drawn down, it happened as always, the Union Jack was lowered over Jerusalem, and with that, the colors were folded up and shipped off to the coast. And at 11:30 that night, on the 14th of May, 1948, they were placed on a ship and brought back to Great Britain. It was the sign of the British withdrawal. The next morning, basically, the British were out of there. Now, 4 o'clock that afternoon, on the 14th, celebrating the imminent creation of the State of Israel. A group of people then gathered together, I believe in Jerusalem, might have been Tel Aviv, but I think it was in Jerusalem, and the key there, the most important individual there, was David Ben-Gurion. And he stood underneath a portrait of Theodor Herzl. Because this is the moment in which the dream of Theodor Herzl was about to take place. And with that declared the establishment of the State of Israel. They had already pulled together a philharmonic. And for the first time now, the world heard the strains of the Hatikva, the national anthem of Israel. So see the sequence that taking place here is that in 4 o'clock in the afternoon, you have the State of Israel declared. 11 o'clock that night, you know, less than 6 hours later, seven and a half hours later, the British have taken down their flag and are already shipping it back to Great Britain along with their people. That night, two other groups are going to be very upset about what's happening. One of those is going to be Chaim Weizmann and his followers, because he was basically frozen out of the process. Here's the fellow who carried the water for the creation of the State of Israel from the death of Theodor Herzl in 1903 all the way up to now. And basically, he's nudged aside. There are a lot of internal differences over the way this thing should happen. And so he's basically put on the outs. And the others, of course, are going to be the Arabs. Arabs are incensed about this. They're incensed about what happens at the United Nations, that half of Palestine has been carved up and handed over to people they consider to be illegitimate. Now, these are people who have been in this country for only 20, 30 years, and they feel that they had been schnookered, you know, by the British and by the United Nations, and they're just angry. And so they're going to take matters into their own hands. At dawn the next day, on the 15th of May, 1948, the Arab Legion, which is the military wing of the King of Jordan, Transjordan, attacks. And so now war is underway. So Israel is less than 6 hours new, and already there's an attack underway by Jordan. Egypt attacks through the Gaza Strip and Beersheba. In the north, the Lebanese army attacks. And remember that, by and large, Lebanon is still heavily Christian. So many of these are Christian Arabs. But they're seeing this as an Arab conflict, not a religious conflict, but an Arab conflict. Basically, they're looking at it as Middle Eastern Arabs versus European Jews. Mm-hmm. That's okay. And then Iraq receives permission from Jordan to transport its army all the way through Jordan to join in the attack. Syria mobilizes its army and stands at the border, but doesn't attack. And so now all of a sudden, Israel, which is less than 6 hours old, is now being besieged by all of these countries. It looks as though it's going to be over in a day or two. But everyone counted out prematurely the Israelis. The Israelis were well aware that they were going to have to defend their new country. And they had already organized an army of 30,000 men. So the Haganah had already had military operations way before this. And so there they had an army of 30,000 men. They also had another 10,000 men who had been drawn up for local defense. These are old men and boys. Mm-hmm. And then another 25,000, which they call the Home Guard. So it's a pretty considerable group. Mm-hmm. Added to that, they also had 2,000 very trained and hardened terrorists in the Irgun, as well as another, by this time, around 800 members of the Stern Gang. So, you know, it's a considerable force. The Arabs attacked with around 40,000 men. However, their army was not professional. Basically, the only professionals in the entire Arab multiple armies were the 10,000 members of the Arab Legion. which is the Jordanian group, which had been trained by the British in order to protect themselves from the Wahhabists. You know, now they're being used against the Jews. And quite honestly, it's one of these deals, we're going to see this again and again, that the Arabs turn out to be their own worst enemies because they were not united. Each of them feared each other as much as they feared the new Israel. King Farouk, the king of Egypt, which is a huge country, which you know could have had huge resources, he was more afraid of the two Hashemite brothers, one of them running Jordan and the other one Iraq. Syria was afraid of Jordan, thinking that Jordan might come in and grab some of its land. Jordan, the Transjordan, wanted Palestine for itself, not for independence. So each of these countries sort of balanced each other off. And what you had at the very beginning with this attack and with the fighting was nothing more or less than terrorist acts and counter-terrorist acts and terrible slaughters, the kind of things that are in our daily news even today. You had a gathering of the Irgun terrorist organization, the Stern Gang organization, and the new Israeli army that came into one spot and slaughtered 245 civilians in the beginning of this conflict. The Arabs responded by killing a convoy of doctors and nurses, some 77 who were on the road heading up to Mount Scopus to try to help people. 77 of them are murdered. This fighting then that goes on, it's not an organized war as we would think of today, but it was just a terrible terrorist, counter-terrorist bloodbath. And finally, by December of 1948, so we have June, July, August, September, October, November, December, about 7-8 months of this fighting, finally a ceasefire was arranged between the Israelis on the one side and the Arab League on the other. I'm sorry, the Arab Legion on the other. That's the military part of the, that's the trained part of the Arab military. When the ceasefire takes place then, Syria and Iraq both pull out of the war. They go back up to their homes and lick their wounds. In February of 1945, just a couple months later then, an armistice is signed between Israel and Egypt.
49?
I'm sorry, 48. 49, yes. Okay. 49. What ends up happening is that, okay, this 1948 war, this is the first terrible conflict, and what happens is it is a clear victory for the Israelis. There is no victory anywhere for the Palestinians or for the Arabs. And what ends up happening then is that Israel gets not only the portion that she had gotten from the United Nations mandate, but also another 80% of the territory that the Palestinians were supposed to get. So they're the big losers in this. Nearly a million Palestinian Arabs became refugees. A million. Many of them fled, you know, during the fighting. They fled. These are not military people. These are, you know, shopkeepers and farmers and herders and shepherds and, you know, that kind of thing. And so they fled for their lives. And many of them fled down into Gaza, which was at the time was Egyptian territory, and it became a very overpopulated area. Many of them fled to Jordan. In fact, so many of them fled to Jordan that there were more Palestinian refugees in Jordan than there were Jordanians.
Oh my gosh.
Isn't that something? Many of them fled to Syria, others to Lebanon. And there, refugee camps were set up. And these camps are still there today. It's 1948.
Oh my gosh.
You know, 55 years later, a whole generation has been born in these camps, and others made their way to other countries. Some to Saudi Arabia, some to the United States. I mentioned before that the single largest Arab-speaking group within the United States were Christian Arabs, over 100,000, like 107,000 Arabs, but of those 107,000, about 103,000 were actually Christian Arabs. Many of those many of them coming from Lebanon, but also Palestinian.
Oh.
Yeah, and these are mainly Palestinian Christians who are fleeing to the Western countries, and they have a natural ability to do that. They're fellow Christians. There's a lot of sympathy for their situation. It's also something that the Israelis are very happy to see, because by and large, most Palestinian politicians and professionals in Palestine in the interwar years were Palestinian Christians.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're talking about farmers and orchard keepers and shepherds and all that, those were mainly Palestinian Muslims. Palestinian Christians tended to be city folk who were the upper middle class, middle class.
Mm-hmm.
And now with that group gone, it would be easier to control the territory. David Ben-Gurion, now the first president of Israel, really the founder of the State of Israel, begins then attracting more Jews from throughout the world to come to Israel. And there's just a tremendous effort to try to get more population in. The idea being that this would seal out Palestinians from ever being able to come back into Palestine. Interestingly enough, it attracted many Middle Eastern Jews. Not so much European. Most of the Europeans have already left and done whatever they were going to do. Come to the United States, Canada, South America, Australia, wherever. Middle Eastern Jews had pretty much either moved by then or were stuck in communist countries. There was no more, you know, once the communist countries took over after the Second World War, there wasn't a heck of a lot of movement taking place then. So it's actually a lot of Middle Eastern Jews who are then moving to Israel. That has another effect on it, which is a sad effect, and that is the depopulation of Arab countries of their Jewish populations.
Mm-hmm.
Now, these are Jews who had lived there, many of them before the time of Christ, and now these populations are lost, and as a result of that, you have a greater polarization between Arabs and Jews.
Right.
Arabs and Jews had always lived together, along with Christians. Many Arab Christians had always lived together in relative peace for centuries and centuries. It's one of the hallmarks of medieval and early modern Islam, is its incredible tolerance for the three religions of the Bible. But now what you have is a movement of Jewish populations out of these areas. And so as a result, the whole dialogue of the great religions breaks down. It's a rather sad thing in itself. In 1952, there is a change. It's an internal thing, but not entirely, that takes place in Egypt. King Farouk, who is a rather corrupt character, was off vacationing and being a playboy in Europe when one of his generals decided that he had had enough and it was time to bring Egypt into the 20th century. This was Gamal Abdel Nasser. And he's an Arab nationalist. As I say, he wants to bring Egypt into the 20th century. He, like so many other Arabs, is embarrassed by the poor showing of Arab arms in the 1948 war. And so he attempts then to nationalize Egypt and bring it forward. The one thing that Egypt has going for it is the Suez Canal.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1956, he nationalizes the Suez Canal, invites the British and the French engineers to leave. They did, most happily, thinking that the Egyptians wouldn't know how to run the canal system. And within a couple weeks, they'd be asked to come back after the Arabs had messed it up. Well, the fact of the matter is that the understudies, the Egyptian understudies, had learned the lessons well, and they ran the Suez Canal very well without the British.
Mm-hmm.
Added to this was then Nasser's refusal to allow Israeli ships to go through the Suez Canal. That would cut off all commerce between Israel and the entire subcontinent of Asia. That was just quite a thing. Ultimately, that's going to lead to another war in which the British and the French are going to get involved, even in invading Egypt itself. But that's another story. What I want to point out is this Arab nationalism and how it's rearing itself up in the 50s mm-hmm. and you know, from country to country showing itself in different ways. Another one in Iran, which is not an Arabian country. The people of Iran are not Arabs. They're Muslims, but they're not Arabs. And they also have the nationalization of, this time, what they have that's most valuable, which is oil, the oil fields. The Anglo-Iranian Oil Company was seized by the premier of Iran, Mohammad Mossadegh. At the time, the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company was the source of 40% of all the oil in the Middle East. So this is a biggie.
Yeah.
The West boycotted Iran, and there was a crisis within Iran itself. And the crisis was then encouraged both by the United States and by Great Britain. In fact, we're well aware now that there were covert operations by the British Secret Services as well as the United States CIA. And ultimately, Mossadegh was overthrown, and he was replaced by the old monarchy, which was brought back. This was the Shah Reza Pahlavi. There is a quid pro quo for all of this, and that's important too, because once again, there's another lesson that Middle Easterners are learning about dealing with the West, and what they're learning in Iran is they're looking at this story. What they're learning there is that when the West gets involved, and this time for the first time now, the United States is involved in this. Usually, when they talk about West, they're thinking about Britain and France, but now they're seeing the United States involved in this too. When the West gets involved, the governments that are set up are oppressive regimes, and those regimes are propped up by Western military power. And the quid pro quo, this for that arrangement, is that whatever is valuable in that country, as in oil, will be what the West gets in exchange for propping up the corrupt regime. This is not healthy, to say the least. But this is a lesson that that Middle Easterners have learned as a result of these events. And exactly, this is exactly what happened. What happens is that instead of reestablishing the Anglo-American Oil Company, instead an international concern is put together in which various groups would get various amounts of oil. I'll give you an example of this. British Petroleum got 40% of all Iranian oil. Okay. Now, of course, they get a kickback. The government gets a kickback on that, but there's a lot of profits. British Petroleum, another 40% is divided up among five big American oil companies. Shell Oil from the Netherlands gets 10%, and the Compagnie Française de Pétrole gets another 10%. So another, you know, basically the Iranians are frozen out of their own oil. The only one that's going to be getting oil income off of this will be the Shah himself. They can't do anything about it. The Iranian people themselves can't do anything about it. You know, they have this regime.
Mm-hmm.
In Egypt, going back to Egypt again, we have the situation in which General Nasser has taken over the government. He has frozen the Israelis out of using the Suez Canal. There is a lot of recrimination going back and forth between certainly Israel and Egypt, who had signed this armistice from 1948, but they're not exactly on talking terms. This is now 1956.
Okay,
so it's only 8 years after that war. And the end result is that the Israelis attack Egypt in a preemptive attack. They claimed that Egypt was about to attack them. And when they did, this was all, by the way, it's all prearranged between the British, the French, and the Israelis. The Israelis would attack. The British and French would declare that this was a war that would destroy the Suez Canal. And so in order to protect this world resource, they would come in and simply stop the two sides from fighting. The fact of the matter is that the Egyptians weren't fighting at all.
Mm-hmm.
They'd just been attacked. But nonetheless, in comes Great Britain and France, and they declare an ultimatum of a ceasefire. And when Nasser refuses, then immediately they take over the Suez Canal, supposedly for safekeeping. Mm-hmm. Their intention then is to topple Nasser. Mm-hmm. This does not fly internationally. It's not well received. However, this is fall of 1956. The United States was deeply involved in its elections. And so this was between Adlai Stevenson and the incumbent Eisenhower, Dwight D. Eisenhower. Neither side wanted to get involved in this because this is going to be one of those October surprises.
Mm-hmm.
It could swing the vote one way or another. So basically the United States is out. In 1956, if you remember, fall of 1956, the Soviet Union has just marched into Hungary.
Mm.
So the two big superpowers that could do something about this were simply occupied with something else. On October 28th, the Israelis had attacked. On October 31st, you know, trick or treat, happy Halloween, the British and the French fly over Egyptian airfields and a bomb the Egyptian airfield so that the Egyptian Air Force is not able to respond. Then what happens is that Nasser immediately then takes ships into the Suez Canal and scuttles the ships in the canal so nobody can use the canal now. The United Nations gets together, the Security Council, to condemn the British and French for their unilateral actions. However, both France and Great Britain have a veto, and so they veto this condemnation of their actions. After the election is over, the British and French then turn to Eisenhower and say, "We want your blessing. Support us in what we've done in Egypt." And Eisenhower said, "No. What you did was wrong, and I'll have nothing. I'm not going to support you. I'll have nothing to do with it." Well, that's at that time. Then, the Soviet Union, and by this time we're talking about Nikita Khrushchev, tells the British and the French, "Get out of Egypt," and he hints at possibly using an atomic bomb to force it. That gets everybody all upset. And the Prime Minister of Great Britain then resigns because he's lost all credibility. This is Eden. And you have what then becomes known as the Suez Reflex. Okay, British foreign policy basically from then on is going to be tied to the United States. When you look at British foreign policy from 1956 onward, the two, U.S. and Great Britain, work absolutely hand in glove. There are very few times when Britain does anything without having informed the United States at least, or at least informed the United States, and in most cases gotten the collusion with the United States. Same thing is also true. Great Britain has been the closest ally of the United States throughout all of this the last 50 years. And a lot of this is due to the Suez complex, to make sure we don't end up on the wrong side of an issue with each other. Even during the Falklands War back in the 1980s, when Britain went it alone in their struggle against Argentina, the United States, while it was neutral in this, because after all, Argentina was a member of the Organization of Latin American States with the United States, the American States with the United States, and of course we do have the Monroe Doctrine. At the same time, the Reagan administration fed the Thatcher administration in Great Britain with intelligence information. There's a short little war, but it was quite ugly. When the war then comes to an end, It's the United Nations. This is probably the finest moment of the UN.
Yeah.
Darn many. So let's celebrate this one. The United Nations sent in peacekeepers. And basically, these are the Blue Helmets. And they separated the Israelis from the Egyptians. And they stayed there for 11 years.
Wow.
This continued on. So there you have now, this is the second war. You have the one in 1948. Mm-hmm. Then in 1956, there's the second war. The next one happens 11 years later. And that's in 1967. Again, it's an action on the part of Abdel Gamal Nasser, in which he takes and closes off down in the southern part of the Sinai Peninsula, Egypt. There's a little tiny area called the Gulf of Aqaba,
okay.
And he closes that off. And so that becomes impossible. Again, the Suez Canal is closed off to everybody in the world. They hadn't cleared it at that point. And now the Gulf of Aqaba is closed off. So once again, the Israelis, who had built a port in order to get their goods out to Asia, they're again cut off. And again, they take a preemptive strike. This is in 1967, and the leader of the Israeli army is Moshe Dayan. This is known as the Six-Day War. Once again, an incredible embarrassment for Arab military arms. In 6 days, Moshe Dayan has occupied the Gaza, the Sinai Peninsula, which is a big sandbox, there's not much there, the West Bank, which had been part of Jordan, was now taken over all the way to the Jordan River. Okay, from Jerusalem all the way over to Jordan. In the north, the Golan Heights, taken away from Syria. And Arab Jerusalem has now been occupied. In this six-day war, the Israeli army suffered 1,000 casualties. The Arabs suffered 18,000. This was a humiliation that was compounded upon a humiliation. And in 1970, Nasser died. Now was an opportunity for some change, and the change came in the form of his successor. And this was Anwar Sadat. Now, Anwar al-Sadat is today held in high esteem because he's the one who brokers peace with Israel. But this was... We're in 1970 right now, okay, a little bit earlier on. What Sadat did was, in order to break the impasse and to do something to improve the possibilities for another, if there's another war, he doesn't want to see Egypt defeated so badly as it has been 3 times in a row now, he turns to the Soviet Union and begins receiving arms from the Soviet Union, military technology from the Soviets. Soviets have been involved in Egypt for a number of years already with Nasser, particularly in building the Aswan Dam. Now they're going to be involved in bringing in military hardware, particularly surface-to-air missiles, to knock out Israeli jets. However, in 1972, he kicked them all out. And we're not entirely sure why, but I think probably it turns out that the Soviets were also sending over lots of spies as well as military advisors in arms. Yeah. Now, he took an incredible risk, and in 1973 helped to organize yet another war. This time around, they thought, well, we're going to show the Israelis, we're going to attack during their holiest time.
Uh-huh.
So they attacked on Yom Kippur. It's known as the Yom Kippur War. Now, surrounding all of this is a whole series of events that had taken place that should be a little bit more in our memory.
Okay.
The hijacking of airplanes. There were lots and lots of airplanes that were being hijacked by Palestinians at this time, the PLO, the Palestinian Liberation Organization. And if you remember, these things were on the nightly news. Mm-hmm. But at that time, what they did was they would land the planes in a field way off from everywhere. They would then take the passengers off the plane. They would get attention. They would make a speech about how terrible things are in Palestine and how the Israelis have been oppressing them. And then they'd blow up the plane with nobody in it. Uh-huh. You know, so this was the kind of Palestinian, this was the Palestinian response. Their terrorist response was to blow up planes after making political statements. Now, all of this changes at the Munich Olympics. And there you have a group of Palestinians that go in and murder Israeli athletes. And this was cold-blooded. And this came as an incredible shock. And you remember the events of that, but they had held the Israeli athletes hostage for several days in Olympic Village in Munich. And then they arranged with the German government to get to take the hostages out onto helicopters and then to get them out of Munich. Of course, the Germans had set up a unit at the airport to basically take out the terrorists. The Israelis told the Germans, now, you know, think about the relations here. You get these Germans and Israelis, you know? Yeah. And so the Israelis are telling the Germans, you know, you guys are soft. You don't know how to deal with these guys. We do. Let us bring in our SWAT teams, and you just stand back and provide security. Well, the Germans were like, who do you think we are? We've been at the war business for centuries. We can do this. Well, they bungled it. They really did. And as a result, they killed, these are the Germans, killed many of the Israeli athletes, as well as killing all the Palestinians. After this, the Israelis decide, okay, this is it. Now we're not playing games. And they then put together their own unit that would literally hunt down any Palestinian who had been involved in this this event, in this massacre in Munich. And what happened is then you have a series of assassinations that take place in the Middle East, in Europe, and they're surgical strikes where they're just taking out that one Palestinian. And the European countries are quite upset about this. But, you know, they don't know, they can't catch the Israelis doing this. They're too good. Until a terrible event happened up in Sweden. This is known as the Lillehammer disaster. And there what you had was the Mossad, the Israeli Secret Service, assassinated a Palestinian at a bus stop. And it turned out they thought they had misunderstood this guy. They thought he was one of the assassins, one of the Palestinian terrorists. In fact, he was simply a medical worker who was working at a hospital in Sweden. And they murdered this man right in front of his girlfriend. And the Swedish police caught one of the Mossad operatives, and the whole thing unfolded. It was a terrible, terrible PR nightmare for the Israelis. But these are the events that are happening at the time of the Yom Kippur War. On the 6th of October, 1973, at 4 o'clock in the morning, Moshe Dayan found out that Israel was about to be attacked from Egypt and from Syria. The army was already on high alert, but almost immediately you had a number of reversals. For one thing, the Israelis now had planes shot out of the, you know, using Soviet equipment, shot out of the sky. Israeli tanks were being destroyed for the first time on battlefield. So the first day or two was something of a disaster, until then they got geared up, and once again Israeli military might showed itself on every battlefield. And this went on for several days until finally world powers stepped in. The Soviet Union offered to broker a ceasefire. The Israelis refused. The United States called the United Nations Security Council. But that's all that they did. France and Britain wouldn't get involved. Ultimately, what happened then was after the Israelis had been victorious on every front, by October 18th, then they're willing to talk. And here you have President Nixon, Richard Nixon, now brokering a peace through the efforts of Henry Kissinger that eventually then in late October of 1973 brought about a ceasefire. In January of 1974 brought about a disengagement of the forces. And later, ultimately, the Egyptian-Israeli Accord, which would have been the foundation for peace, except that the president was involved in something else, the Watergate hearings,
mm-hmm.
and impeachment. And so he was never able to use the advantage that he had with Henry Kissinger to bring about some kind of a peaceful settlement in that area. Well, when we come back, we're going to look at the overflow of the 1973 Yom Kippur War, because it also has tremendous repercussions. Much of it has to do with oil diplomacy. And we're going to see that this is just an intractable problem that just is not going away.
All right. I don't see the solution yet, Father. Obviously.
Well, you got about seven books to read.
And,
yeah, all right. And when you finish those, let me tell you, you're still not going to see the solution. Yeah.
Well, we hope and pray that the Holy Father is finding a solution for us.
Well, I think that's true, and we'll explore that toward the end of this sad story.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Father. Another very pertinent, light, interesting topic that we need to really be.
Yeah, I think it's very important for us. Yeah.
Shall we close with a prayer today?
Okay. Glory be to the Father, to the Son, and to the Holy Spirit.
As it was in the beginning,
is now,
and
ever shall
be,
world
without
end.
Amen.
May Almighty God bless you in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit.
Amen.